your rooms are popping on the second floor. No chance to emigrate. I'm deep in debt and now it's much too late.
Ja, das Gespräch mit Ute Meterbauer in Berlin wurde auch zusammen mit Martin Saar geführt. Jetzt folgt das direkt im Radiostudio, Radio-Workshop-Studio im Ein- und Ausgangsbereich des Bockenheimer Depots, das Gespräch mit Rax, Rax Media.
The Warehouse Project here in March, it's next week, and the question for the TAT was that you will make a collaboration, and it's a project which is titled The Warehouse, basically looks at what basically happens to people who feel compelled to leave their homes and journey to other countries where they are treated by the state as illegal aliens. And now the first question is a more biographical question, because you're coming from New Delhi as the Rax Media Collective. The question is, how does it came that you developed those kind of internet projects? When did you start your work, and how does it come that you are now as aliens here in the chat? I'm working in a theater. Yeah. So, who wants to start? Maybe Monica.
Sure. Rax Media Collective is actually 14 years old by now, I think, or 13 or 14 years old. We began working together. We came out of film school. We were working together in film school, and we started together that many years ago. And we began as a filmmaking collective. We made documentary films together, especially in the essay mode. And at some point, we decided that we needed to do something which would create a space for more interdisciplinary forms of engagement. Because no matter how exciting film is, we felt that there needed to be a more horizontal expansion of ideas with people who were doing different kinds of work. Then we collaborated with two other people to start Sarai, which is a space in New Delhi.
Yeah.
A place for interdisciplinary work, research and practice on media and the city, very broadly. We can give you more details afterwards. And now there's a number of people collaborating with us, working over there, and Rux works at Sarai. The internet projects in that sense began during our time at Sarai. We started Sarai in 2000, mid-2000, and we went public in 2001. And Shubha will tell more about what work we've been doing. Mm.
As Monica just said, the basic idea was to try and create networks of processes and creative works and ideas. And for us, our definition of what was new media was to look at all forms of communication practices. So the internet was one form of communication practice. And so we work equally with print now, or with video material, or with audio. And what interested us was both forms of making which are shared and collaborative, which the internet sometimes enables, not always, but sometimes does enable, which led us to rethink the whole idea of a cultural or a communication practice, and led us to rethink the idea of how we collaborate with other people, because we were always consistent with the idea of our work as a networked collaborative process. But we began also thinking of how we work with other institutions, other agencies, other energies that we come into contact with. And it was these set of processes that actually perhaps indirectly led us to engage with the TAT last year, which came out of a project that we had initially done for the Generali Foundation in Vienna, which was looking at call center work, looking at the idea of online labor and the relationship between gender and labor and identity. And as you know, in India, there's a lot of what is known as BPO, or business processing, outsourcing, that happens. And yeah, we wanted to create a kind of a work that was a video and text installation, but with characters. So it was like our first foray into the world of performance, although it's not a performance by live human beings, but it's a performance in text. And Louise Neri, who had begun working with the Tat at that time, became very interested in this idea, and she invited us to come and do a presentation of our work last year in October. And I think since then we've been having conversations that have finally resulted in this residency that we are now beginning from yesterday.
Yeah. So
what's
your part in RAGS? Do you have different kind of
No, I think as a collective we don't really work with specific division of labor. Most of the ideas are shared. We try to build kind of shared resources to work on together. And that has been primarily what we have tried, though by training it becomes that we tend to specialize on something. So while making films, I may do sound, Monica may do camera, Shuddha may do the scripting. But now at present, last 4 or 5 years, we have been more or less very mobile in our own relationship to different crafts. And all the work, most of the kind of ideas or the kind of installation or frameworks that we develop are very shared in terms of its imaginary and practices. So it's, we won't frame it as a division of labor that I do this or she do that or Shuddha does this. It's more to do with how, what kind of practices we are trying to open up with other people and within us. That would be broadly how we work.
So to come back to Sarai, because there's a term, it's called Cyber Mohalla, and in Mohalla in Hindi and Urdu means neighborhood, and the question is Sarai Cyber Mohalla. How do you collect Cyber Mohalla works on your website? Because maybe this relates to the warehouse project you will make maybe here in the chat.
I think it's a very interesting question that you're asking, because Cyber Mohalla, if one discusses it, is actually a project which is very material. It is experimental media lab set up in now 3 areas of the city, in squatter settlements and resettlement areas, obviously in working class kind of areas. And this is a collaboration with an NGO which works in alternatives in education. And the idea was to create a space a bit like Sarai, in the sense that you have this, you have a space to be able to explore your the world around you in different forms, whether it's text or sound or diaries or interaction, especially interaction, the space of fluid interaction, of conversation, of people commenting on each other's work and so on. What you see on the website is accumulation of that material over, now it's been 2.5-3 years actually, of Cyber Mohalla project. And each stage of that we try and, with the young people, the people there are between 16 and 25, and about 15 people in each lab, and it's not like a, it's not time bound. You come and spend as many months or years as you want, and when people leave it's because of circumstances, you know, they're shifting or they're getting married or whatever it might be. So it's not time bound, it's not bound in terms of a horizon. You're not expected to do learn some skills and go out and do a job kind of thing. It's much more in terms of exploration. And I think the connection with the warehouse, I think, is interesting, because what we're trying to do in the warehouse is exactly the same thing in some way, which is thinking about the world that you are in. But in warehouse, we tend to complicate it a little bit more, because when we're talking about dislocation, when we're talking about leaving and abandoning one framework for another, whether voluntarily or involuntarily, what you have is a situation that your material reality is so transformed that your commentary on that, your reflections on that, are also mutating because of your dislocation. And the idea is, in that transference of location, how much of memory is getting transformed? How can one think about that which has been left behind and that which has been arrived at or not arrived at quite often, because many people do not necessarily arrive anywhere. They're often in that moment of limbo when you have left something behind and not necessarily reached somewhere because of structures of borders, structures of surveillance and containment, which especially we understand in this part of the world, although it's not unique to Fortress Schengen. I mean, one uses the word Fortress Schengen, but I think it's, one can see that in many other parts of the world as well.
Yeah.
But the Cyber Mohalla experience is very crucial in our understanding of the warehouse project, because the Cyber Mohalla experience has given us a way of engagement, of trying to find a way in which we are not just sort of enforcing our argument or saying this is what it is, but we're trying to find a framework in which our reality can engage with other people's reality and create a kind of much more open relationship of dialogue. Wouldn't you think that, Rivesh?
Actually, what I think the similarity would be also in terms of kind of production of affects, which are fragmentary, plural, and affects, and which does not allow you to immediately cohere it into a worldview. So it escapes something. So you continuously try to engage with this production, which could be engagement with your material reality, social conflict, power relationships, simple memories of objects, object relationships. And on the production of that affect, you create a condition in which you have to rethink your everyday life, rethink the assumptions of your everyday life, things that you would have not thought and would have just passed by. It makes it appear. So Warehouse Project somewhere tries to draw from this production of affect, this production of very plural, fragmentary frameworks by which people make sense of reality, and which does not totalize itself, which does not, you know, immediately totalize and say we have understood it. So yeah. That's the relationship, intellectually relationship. And also the idea of the archive. What I think the Warehouse Project produces for us is an archive of memory, an archive of abandonment. You know, you abandon a world of materiality, and how do you imagine it? How do you think it? So it produces an archive, and archives, and a non-classified archive, non-cataloged archive.
Mm-hmm.
So what does this archive produce is a possibility of new forms of knowledge and new forms of engagement, which cannot be totalized in one work. So it is not that from this archive of the warehouse, we will produce one work which will say we have understood this experience. We will produce a fragment. Similarly, a performance group can produce another fragment, or a writer can produce another fragment, or a poet can produce another fragment, or an academic can produce another fragment, an activist can produce another fragment. So it's a multiplying production, which are contending, contemplating on the similar things, but does not claim for itself that it's an understood experience. So the production of this archive and this generative model from the archive where you produce other works is something that opens up the dialogue between these two trends, these two experiences.
Yeah. Well, I think for the other interesting link is that in the Cyber Mohalla project, the problem was often how does one interpret the world around you, and very often the task of interpretation of the world would use as a sort of hermeneutic entry little objects like a lock, a radio.
Telephone.
A telephone, and so on. And that led us to a lot of interesting thoughts about the place of objects as things to think with, not just things to work with, but things to think with and things to build relationships with thought and feeling. So when we were thinking about the Warehouse Project, it seemed, it sort of suggested itself quite naturally that when you're thinking about an expression that we thought when we were writing our notes was that a person who is, let's say, detained in like the big facility you have in Frankfurt near the airport, which is a detention center for people who are trying to come into this space, he or she is in a sense a prisoner of the clock, but also an exile from the calendar, because they have no means to construct a plan for their life for the moment that they're there. But every moment, every minute is in a sense already constructed for them. So let's say two objects, a clock and a calendar, become ways of thinking about the reality that you live in. So instead of, the operation was the reverse. Just as in the Cyber Mohalla project, we started with the question is how do you describe your world? And you ended perhaps with very minute reflections on objects, very detailed, precise reflections on objects. Here we as the Rux Media Collective, offer a community of whoever wants to work on this project a gift of representations of objects. And so we create this small booklet which contains images of objects and a website which contains, again, a database of those objects. And these objects and their images are invitations for people to inscribe whatever they wish to inscribe. So in a sense, the process that we have observed during our engagement with the Cyber Mohalla project is turned on its head, and we are now offering an inversion of it and waiting to see what happens. So that could be a way of thinking about a relationship between the two. Mm.
So we had now this interview with Ute Meterbauer, and you collaborated with her in Oslo and on the Documenta 11. And the question is, if you will work with asylum seekers in a project like the TAT, the warehouse project, or in Brussels or in Oslo, so you are always based in art projects, and the way you work together, it's always fragmented and things you are doing, no, it's not fragmented in the way you are always, you have always a chance to get into new art projects, and what you are doing is always represented in art projects. So the question is, how bring you this connection or relation between the situation of asylum seekers to be illegal or to be in a crisis of life together into your art projects, because your situation is not the same in this kind of working in art projects and the situation of asylum seekers. Mm. So how do you see, is this only a metaphor or?
Yeah. I think what it would be interesting to think about is the fact that that being illegal is not only a function of borders. If you're in a city like Delhi, which has got 14 million people or 15 million people, no one is quite sure right now how many people there are, what you find is that your presence in the city is defined, for example, by the way the city has been planned and imagined by those who imagine and plan cities. So your position as a citizen of that city is not given. You are not necessarily a citizen unless you can be defined as one by certain structures. Unless you can prove your citizenship. And I think the notion of illegality is a much more complex one when you actually inhabit a space where many people in their own cities, in their own countries, are at the same time illegal or not necessarily having entitlement to what some of us, for example, three of us, would consider normal and natural. And part of the first project that we did, which was part of Documenta 11, which was shown in Documenta 11, which was entirely worked at and spent all our time in Delhi, was exactly about this tension between the master plan and the moment of reality. How does one think and understand law and spatialization in which people are constantly the sort of the least reflected upon, and how does one understand the relationship between citizenship and legality, and who frames that? So as a starting point, I think the notion of asylum, we come from a space where the city is a space where people come from for asylum, not only from, say, Bangladesh or, what is now other parts, but also from, like, villages and from other cities and from other towns. It's a city of continuous migration, of continuous people flowing in and continuously trying to find a place for themselves. So for us, the provocation for thinking about what is permissible and what is not actually began from our lived experience of being in Delhi. And the first thing that we did was part of that. But I think as working at Sarai, which is a much more continuous life that we lead, every day you are there from the morning till night, you're working with other people, you're thinking about these things, I think that our work for us is not just in terms of art and non-art. I think it's a kind of process in which writing an essay, inviting other people to participate in writing something or creating something or having a seminar or having a talk or showing a film or going out and participating in other things in the city are kind of starting points, which are not just about making art or not making art. I think one manifestation of the ideas that we're concerned with and the work that we like to talk about or the questions that we want to provoke, one framework is definitely what could be considered the art project. And I think it's interesting because art is in a moment of flux. I mean, what is it and what it can be is so open to question that I think this is what we find exciting about using the form of the art project to provoke these questions. Thank you.
Felicia, excuse me, there is a difference, I don't know if you said about illegal...
We cannot hear you for the recording, that's the problem.
Okay.
We should discuss this later.
No, but then when the discussion, I don't understand, can you... No, because asylum seekers are, not illegal people. Because
yeah,
not
really,
not.
But...
There's a difference there, no? And you work with immigrants then.
But the question is, with art projects, so what do you think, what is art in relation to your work, maybe? What is
I think that, the division between art and other aspects of life is something that we have never quite been comfortable with. I mean, we see our work as occupying a continuous spectrum, where the writing, the research, the manifestation in different projects, which sometimes the same project may be recognized as art in one instance and may be recognized as research in another, it's up to the community that wishes to recognize it. For our purposes, we are seeking an engagement with our curiosities and with our imagination, with our creativity. Whether it gets called art or not is not a question that we have to answer. It's up to a public engagement as to where it gets contextualized. Inasmuch as art spaces or contemporary art spaces are at the moment in an enormous turmoil where lots of other energies are coming in. So you have architects or doctors or lawyers or people who work with the economy who work in art spaces. So we see our incursion or our entry into an art space is similar. So if you ask the question about, let's say, Utameta Bauer, I think that what is interesting in the Documenta process this time, Documenta 11, was the kind of dialogue that the curation process entered into with a range of curiosities. And I think that that's an interesting model, not only for the art world, but also for other practices. I mean, it could be the other way around, that historians invite artists to talk to them, you know, and engage with the process of writing history. Just as artists, so the art world is now often asking historians and philosophers to engage with it. And that's an interesting kind of conjecture or a moment where we and many others like us, I think, are located today.
Excuse me, you think it is irrelevant, this question then? Is it irrelevant? Is art, is not art? Is space irrelevant?
No, not... Some question may not address what we try to do, in a sense that it's not a question of art or non-art. It's a question of what does the art context open itself up to. And if it opens itself up to many kinds of discourses, many kinds of ways of looking at the world, ways of being in the world, the presentness of that world becomes more complex, more dialogic, more open-ended. I think that is a very critical challenge in art context, which art context opens up for all of the society. And if you look at other institutions in society, whether it is school, the universities, or your military, or any institution, they never reflected what it is all about. Why is it there? What is the public it is addressing? So that internal process of interrogation in art has been very sharp, whether from a crisis or whether from different margins. And that allows other histories to emerge within it. And that opens up itself to a more open-endedness to the world, more presentness to the world. And that's very critical. One is to appreciate that world.
Yeah, to come back to the situation now on migration, because the Biennale in Berlin has now this hub migration, and how, and you will make your art project or your your warehouse project in Brussels too, and they describe it in, I think, in an interesting way, as political fictions Brussels, that the European Parliament in Brussels, a forbidden city that is accessible to non-functionaries only under exceptional circumstances, presents itself as an architectural compromise between an oversized cake and a half sunken luxury steamer, between puffed up Art Nouveau set pieces and the stylistic standard of a ubiquitous postmodern bureaucracy. Important stimuli for Schengen topology. Topologie Schengens. Also ich lese vielleicht kurz weiter auf Deutsch. Hier werden die biopolitischen Szenarien kodifiziert, nach denen Migration verwaltet, blockiert, in Bewegung gesetzt, reguliert und verwahrt wird, ebenso wie die Raumlogiken weit entfernter Territorien hier festgelegt und produziert werden. Der Zugang zu diesem Gebäude wird durch eine Firma reguliert. Also in addition to security services for the European Parliament, transportation of money and prisoners and running private prisons, the consortium Group 4 also offers detention centers for refugees in the United States, Puerto Rico, South Africa, New Zealand, Canada and Curaçao, with a capacity of approximately 40,000 beds. This state of the coexistence of opposites is, however, also manifested in another category of spaces in which various spheres mix that are, strictly speaking, incompatible. In Brüssel ist eben die Botschaft sozusagen dieser. So existiert im Brüsseler Botschaftsviertel auch die universelle Botschaft, ein von Saint-Papier besetztes Botschaftsgebäude. Do you know this?
The universal embassy.
Yeah, of Saint-Papier. And the question is now in Frankfurt. We will have this big hub of the airport where a lot of migrants and asylum seekers are coming to this place. But we have no place like in Brussels where you should have this possibility to stay or to come to people to speak. Like, so the question is really, how will you work in Brussels, or what is your intention of working in Brussels and in Frankfurt for this warehouse project?
There's a central conception of space for the warehouse project that I think we need to perhaps articulate. And this is something that occurred when we were in Brussels and looked at the Petit Palais, which is the detention center for what they call illegal aliens, which is that if you stand outside Petit Palais, they allow the detainees to come out from time to time. And people write their names on the bricks of the wall. It's an old chateau. And for us, that was a very interesting, like an epiphanic moment, because it's often in the literature or in films and so on, you see the inner walls of a prisoner's cell, which is filled with people writing their names, because there's a trace, leaving a trace of that I was here and so on. So the outer walls of the detention center could be seen as the inner wall of the prison of the city. And I think that's an interesting thought to think with, that with every refusal of contact with the outsider, which is what is happening in Europe, even in our part of the world, many other places, these societies are also turning themselves into prisons. They suffer under the illusion that they're detaining others, but they're actually, in some very fundamental sense, building a prison in their own minds. And I think that's an important idea that we want to work with, that the detention is not only in the place of the detention center. The person who lives in a city like Frankfurt also undergoes their own processes of detention. And we want to be able to deal with objects and materiality of objects and the illusion that there is a permanence to the city that you live in. Because let's say a person comes from the city of Kabul. There might have been an illusion of permanence once in Kabul. There is no longer. there might have been, there might be an illusion of permanence in the city of Frankfurt, but 50 years ago, in 1945, there was no illusion of permanence in Frankfurt. I mean, most of Frankfurt was bombed out. So there is a sense in which these moments in time which we live in seem to configure themselves as completely permanent. But they are not, they are provisional. And I think that the warehouse project actually wants to bring in some questions very gently about the place of permanence in your life. And who are you? Are you the person inside the detention center or outside? Or do you occupy a kind of in and out position that you sometimes are, but you don't know what you're doing? So our strategies in Frankfurt and Brussels will obviously be different, because in Brussels we may have access to the Petit Palais. In Frankfurt, it's very difficult for even people of Frankfurt to know that there is a detention center at the Frankfurt airport. But we might have to work with people who have occupied these insider-outsider positions, people who have been in and now are out, or people who work with people who are in, let's say, lawyers or human rights activists, or people who are priests in churches, or relatives, or just ordinary people who work on the streets and who might have a relative inside, or who have a history of having been once an asylum seeker. So each space will evolve or provoke its own strategy for working, and that's fine. That's part of the pleasure or the creative intervention of a process like this.
You know, I think what's interesting is that the last 200 or 300 years of history that we've all encountered, but especially what's happened here, is that when you have, in a sense, closed a certain chapter of history, you've said, okay, colonialism finished, imperialism finished, whatever that sort of time can be called, you've retreated home. You know, 1945 was a long time ago, and before that what was happening was also a long time ago in other parts of the world. I think what has been, in a sense, obscured is that facet of history. And I think what the frame illegal migrant or illegal alien or illegal whatever it's framed in actually problematizes again is that obscured history. It brings back, in the living shape of a person, a forgotten past. And I think this is an interesting provocation. People become provocations for other spaces and other people. And it is this tension between obscured histories and how we live our contemporary in those places that wish to forget those obscured histories that the real tension is happening. I mean, people have become a manifestation of things that are much more complicated than just people. Because on a one-to-one level, no one will want to say, I want to hurt other people, or I want to destroy their lives, or I want to, you know. Do you know what I'm saying? At a one-to-one level, you put two people in a room together, they'll come out saying, we love each other, we're great friends, or whatever, but it'll be human engagement. But the human engagement is not what you get. What you get is a structural engagement. And I think it is, and structures are not about people, in that sense.
Yeah, and what is interesting is that if you take the whole image of the boat people, or the people who had dropped in the boat trying to cross one border to another border, you have this history in 19th century, late 18th century, early 18th, and the boat people are not new. Thousands of people went from Europe in search of new land. They were banished. They were either banished out of poverty and loss of
criminality.
Mm. They were all over the world. They were pushed out. That history has almost been closed, as if it has been resolved. I think first now suddenly that the whole new way we have to engage with that history, because that history didn't die out. That history actually got transferred into other lands. Similarly, this. If you had people been pushed as to do labor in other places, you had people been taken over to plantations, indentured laborers, or slave, whatever. So the mass kind of taking out people into different worlds were there. So all this history revisits now in this obscure figure, this very, very vague, very amorphous figure called the illegal immigrant or whatever illegal term. And that history is present and appearing as a nightmare to the contemporary consciousness, which has tried to resolve it, tries to say that I have overcome that history, I am out of it, and now I am living a different life. So that return of the banished, the return of the repressed in that sense, of the European history is coming back. And I think we have very little intellectual resources, very little critical faculties to deal with this new form. because we have to really unlearn a lot of the established assumptions of last 50 years to be able to understand and really empathize with the contemporary in this sense. Because this sudden present in this our contemporary of this obscure figure suddenly poses a very, very real question as to what got resolved in history. What is this history? What is that it is calling back? How can we reread our past? And that is a very critical question, and I think that is being pushed aside in large measure by technical questions about citizenship and technical questions about border. But real philosophical, historical questions are not being asked, because we have to then engage, revisit 500 years of history. And then we have to probably reimagine what we call the globe today. And that is a tough order. And I think one needs to take that challenge now, because otherwise it will be a forgotten, it will be a really a sad part of our history.
Yeah.
It's like a reflection on the slogan, kein Mensch ist illegal, which is something that we see often in Germany. You walk into any underpass or a street, you often come across the sticker, kein Mensch ist illegal. And there's a picture in the new Sarai Reader, the Crisis Media Reader, which Monica took, which is a picture of a woman's face with the slogan, kein Mensch ist illegal, between her eyes. And I think it's very evocative, because it actually also can be reversed to say, I don't know how you say in German, jeder Mensch, everyone is illegal. Even either no one is illegal or everyone is illegal. You know, which is an interesting inversion, because you cannot have an idea of a universal idea of what is, let's say, human rights. If you have that, if you have the idea that people everywhere should have the same entitlement to a good life, then you have then to accept that people everywhere have the entitlement to move and to recreate their lives. The streets of Europe are empty, you know, they're waiting for people to recreate their lives. Or you have to say that no, that's not the case, that there is one kind of life for one part of the world and another kind of life for another part of the world. But you cannot have the principles of universal justice or democracy or open societies and at the same time close the borders. So I think that all parts of the world, whether it's Europe or it's South Asia or America, have to decide whether they want to stay or aspire to be, even whether Europe wishes to aspire to be an open society, a democratic society. Should it become a democratic society, which I don't think it is completely at present. No society is. And if it aspires to be one, then what does it do with its borders? What does it do with the idea of legality and citizenship? What does it do with the idea of where do you locate that enigmatic human figure of the unexpected arrival, you know, of someone who steps into your place?
Yeah. Yeah, so the question is, we have in this Biennale reader on migration, they call it free spaces, and they try to explain this with the way Giorgio Agamben discusses the state of things after salvation. And the question is really, is there a kind of, how will there be a transformation by salvation? And is this a question of how we think singularity? Maybe singularity as a philosophical term is really the opposite of what we would say community is community. And this maybe is a kind of how a European model of thinking is as a kind of philosophy of subjectivity is something which is in opposite to maybe a kind of Indian philosophy or a Buddhistic thinking of community in which we have a different view on what is salvation and what is being what is community in the way people interact together or have this kind of thinking of what is the state, what are rights, and so on. So the question is really, can there be something like a transformation in thinking in the way you develop your projects on the internet? Internet is always kind of a warehouse too.
Yeah,
yes.
But I think one very important insight from Agamben, the bear life, the idea of the bear life, and the way he portrays it in Guantanamo Bay. The idea that here are people who are neither prisoner of war, neither are they part of any sovereign. They're completely out, and it's bare life, you know, it's life,
naked
life in front of power. So that's a very powerful insight. Beyond that, today I think there is a crisis of earlier forms. I was discussing this with Alex in the afternoon. There is a crisis of our ideas of political modernity, because it took for itself granted its own history, the history of European Enlightenment, and constructed a certain form of political modernity, which was intolerant of other histories, other modernity. And since with the periodization of history, what it did was made prehistory or pre-capitalist as a form by which other histories could be banished, or other histories could be said lacks adequate cultural resources to create its own futures. So that's the crisis now at present, where you have us philosophers visiting other forms of belonging, other forms of ways of living and being in society, whether it is in different cultural spaces or different philosophical schools. But I would not go too sharply into constructing totalities like Buddhist or Indian philosophies, because these are also construction of enlightenment, and it is not. There was nothing. I won't say there was nothing called coherent Buddhist philosophy before 17th century. Neither was there was something called coherent Indian philosophy. It was the discovery of text and a certain coherence that was being merged into it. And there are some beautiful work that is done on this, how they produce the religion called Hinduism, produce the religion called Buddhism. And I would not go to create another totality which is in opposition to European totalities. I don't think that the problem can be solved at that level. One needs to really engage with practices, and practices that produces different forms of solidarity or different forms of belonging, not necessarily communitarian belonging. I'm not so sure how that could be done, but I'm sure we would be uncomfortable with shift into non-European ideas of community, because that can also be extremely despotic. The practices, not the idea itself. Mm-hmm. And it wouldn't be a little careful to work towards that kind of drift.
I think we have to examine histories in terms of more complicated issues, rather than what becomes dominant or perceived, because even that is a temporary thing. I think that if you looked at the fiction called European culture, and I insist that it is a fiction 400 years ago, then it has a very different cast of characters than what it has today. If you look at the fiction called let's say Asian culture, or which is meaningless term, but let's say Islamic culture, let's say Hindu, again a meaningless term, but South Asian cultures of various kinds, then the cast of characters, their lines, their scripts, because we are in a theatre space, have very different, the stories are very different. So pre-Renaissance Europe is often a space for emotional excess, a space of unreason. Medieval Islam is a space of before the destruction of the Abbasid Caliphate, medieval Islam is a space for reason, of science. And the oppositions that we are accustomed to today are actually inverted. So these are, we would hesitate to use or deploy these, you know, sort of Huntingtonian clash of civilization kind of metaphors as real descriptions. They're fictions, they're interesting stories, but they need to be seen as interesting stories. And I think that one of the tasks that faces those who, like us or you, who sit across a table coming from different spaces, is to try and see what has often been forgotten in each other's histories. So for me, probably it's quite important to see what has been forgotten in European history. And for you, it may be quite important to see what has been neglected or forgotten in our history, so that we can get a more complicated understanding of the world than the one that we have at present. So let's say that the history of heresy in Christian thought in Europe is something that fascinates us, you know, in the sense of where do ideas of difference come about? How do you construct a different idea of the you know, the polarities of good and evil? Or is there a different notion of salvation?
Mm-hmm.
And similarly, there may be different notions of the self that have been processed out by the way of making monoliths of what is Buddhist or Indian or Hindu philosophy, which, you know, we allude to. So that's part of the project of a conversation. Any conversation when people from different parts of the world enter across a table, I think.
Mm. Yeah, by agape, it's really to look how can something like opens up a possibility of a new. And the question is really how in the European modern thinking, it's really the opposition of, or the polarity of, public spaces in relation to the states. And if we are able to have a public space like this public space here in the chat, it would be possible to think how we can have this as an example for how we can change the community thinking. So the question would be really how to work in a space as an example for the creativity of how people live together, to have this example for creativity of
Yeah, I mean, which is like Sarai, no, Monica, what you say?
No, I was going to say that what you're describing is partly the response to that question itself, isn't it? I mean, the experience of what we see that the TAT is trying to do right now in the last few months, this whole project called Why Now, and the kind of provocation and engagements that it's seeking with the city. And I was just talking to Steve about this just before we started talking, you know, in this conversation, is exactly about that. How do you find practices of engagement, sometimes created by a moment of crisis, which provoke you to think about new forms of conversation? And I think that sometimes this can be very sharply posed. I think, you know, the space is facing that, for example. But in our context, in our specific context, I think the idea of Sarai is a kind of thinking about exactly that. How do you create a space for engagement which is not going to be deterministic in its imagination already? And I think, obviously, there are no answers, and I think that it's been a very complicated experience, sometimes good and sometimes bad, even at Sarai, I mean, in terms of ups and downs. But I think one thing we have learned in the 4 years that we've been working there is the fact that nothing, first of all, what you start off thinking is not what you think 6 months or 1 year or 2 years down the line. Everything gets mutated, everything gets transformed, and the fact that the process is the only way that you can understand anything. There is no means or end. That whole sort of dialogue is kind of broken now. I mean, this whole sort of binary formation of, you know, is this right or is this the right way to do it? It gets completely broken when you actually start working in a mode of practice. That practice can be whether it's making a work, which is, can be called artistic or research or whatever it might be, or it can be a practice of just sitting together and having conversations and enormous numbers of cups of teas, which is exactly what happens at Sarai. A lot of tea gets drunk. Or it's like, you know, calling people in and trying to say to the city that, you know, there's other ways of talking, or let's create a space where things which cannot be said otherwise can be said, and maybe it's uncomfortable for everyone because people, you know, not everyone wants to hear everything. And, you know, when we talk about censorship is a problem, and then the fact is that actually those who are against one censorship are actually for another censorship, and this becomes a difficult debate as well. So it's really about opening up that form of engagement. And I think the notion of salvation is partly because of the fact that one comes from a certain part of the world, it implies a certain kind of an end for me. A salvation implies a certain kind of end moment as opposed to a processual moment. So I don't know exactly how it is being implied in the way Agamben is framing it, but my sort of response is kind of negative in the sense that I am not looking. For me, the process or the experience at Sarai or working as Rux, as a collective, has been entirely about process, and you can never determine what's going to come. But so salvation is not the issue, but a mode of engagement is the issue.
Yeah, indeterminate.
Yeah.
Indeterminate.
Well, you know, salvation has an interesting kind of destiny as a concept. In you refer to Buddhism, at least in some strains of Buddhism, in Mahayana Buddhism, the idea that that you can actually decide to not be saved. because there is an imperative to continue to communicate,
yeah.
which is what the figure of the Bodhisattva is about.
Yeah.
That you, the Bodhisattva decides that he
yeah.
will not, or she or it,
yeah.
will not become a Buddha. So he or she or it will continue to communicate.
Yes, it's a Bodhisattva. It's a picture of human, of the idea of a human being.
Yeah.
So that's what you think is
yeah.
the same like enlightenment.
Yeah.
I
and
think
yeah.
it has the same idea of human.
So to refuse the finality of salvation is in itself a response to the need for more compassion. So, I mean, a compassionate self is one who actually decides, no, I don't want to be removed from the mess of human affairs.
Yeah.
I want to continue to be in a world that is complicated and messy and full of its problems, but this is where I am.
Yeah. So, here's one description for this kind of free space. It's between everything and itself, and maybe this is where we should think transformation of a public space. It's always between everything and it
and itself.
And itself. And that's maybe where you can find new kind of practices if it's not coming to an end. But we are here now in a space which
yeah.
will come to an end. So,
mm.
so what can you do? Find new kinds of
yeah.
creativity. So it's a question, the last question is really, how will you start your project in the Tat? There will be an internal meeting with the organizations, and then at the 12th or 13th of March, you will come back after a kind of Cyber Mohalla in Hamburg.
Mm.
You will come back, and then you will start in working with asylum seekers.
Or with the people who work with the service.
You will have computers here and hotspots, and you will be always online. And I don't know
the logistics of the project, which are still being sorted out. But the idea was to create a space.
You use the space.
Yeah, the idea was to create a space in the Tat, which would be an open, hospitable space, which has got some of the material that we have brought. It would have computers because the warehouse project is also going to be online. But really a hospitable space where people might feel comfortable and to sit and talk and to write and to maybe even just talk. You know, I think very often the idea of just talking about things that have been forgotten or not remembered for various reasons can be... is exactly what we want to start opening out again. So there will be computers and there will be us and there will be books that we have and books you can read, books you can write in. There will be Jan with us and someone else. And, you know, it's really about being a hospitable space for conversation and memory. And whatever form that might take, it might take the form of text or words or internet or whatever people are comfortable being. It might imply that we have to go to their houses, which is also fine because they may not be comfortable coming out over here, which is fair enough, to try and, just to start that conversation no matter what form it takes.
Mm-hmm. And the Sarai reader you did, so you will make a new Sarai reader and you will bring your 6 Sarai readers and... they have different themes. Yeah, this is on crisis. I mean, yeah, it's the last area which theme has a lot. This is the last.
This is the latest one.
On crisis and
crisis media, which is precisely about the ideas of the crisis in the media and the media about the crisis.
Yeah.
Both things. So it's reflecting both on the crises that we see around us at this moment, and also how the media has responded to those crises and why it's responded in the way it has, and what it means to be a media practitioner and to think about all of these things and what other people think about media as it does this. The other ones have been, the last one before this was called Shaping Technologies, looking at technology in everyday life from various perspectives, from free software to cinema to, well, lots of film culture to all of that. Then before that was called The Cities of Everyday Life, looking at urban space.
and the first one was called The Public Domain. So we have four Sarai readers. We have two books from the Cyber Mohalla project.
Yeah.
One is called Bylanes, which is the first book that came out. We have actually three books from the Cyber Mohalla project. The first one is Bylanes, which is the first set of writings that came as much more experiential, raw, first response, affect-driven text. The second one is called The Book Box, which has animations, which has a short film, which has software, free software, which is just meant to be shared. But you also have 10 booklets, which are much more conceptual, looking at phrases like what is it that flows between us, or sometimes some questions betray us, or so it's much more kind of driven by making some phrases more open. And the third book is called The Scratch Book, which is a much more conceptually driven project, which is again an interactive book using which is writing down people's experiences from Cyber Mohalla, but trying to provoke response, which is much more active. So there's three books from Cyber Mohalla.
So we now at the end. So can you say your names and goodbye and hello in Hindi? say goodbye.
My name is Monica Narula, and I'm part of the Lux Media Collective.
And in Hindi.
In Hindi, mera naam Monica hai aur main Lux Media Collective ki saathi hoon.
मतलब आप हेलो और मतलब हिंदी में भी हेलो ही बोलते हैं.
हिंदी में नमस्ते इज बोथ हेलो एंड गुड बाय. सो नमस्ते.
नमस्ते.
नमस्ते. ओके. फिर नेक्स्ट.
या हम जिवेश बागची एंड नमस्ते.
नमस्ते.
माय नेम इज शुद्धा. शुद्धा ब्रदर सेन गुप्ता. और हम तीनों दिल्ली में रहते हैं और हमें फ्रैंकफर्ट में काफी ठंड भी महसूस लग रही है, महसूस हो रही है, लेकिन अच्छा भी लग रहा है. Which means it's cold in Frankfurt, but we enjoy it.
Okay. Yeah, thank you very much for the talk. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, der nächste Radio-Workshop ist mit Arnfried Astl und Silke Scheuermann, dann im TAT sonntags 18 bis 20 Uhr. Am Mikrofon verabschiedet sich Felicia-Herrschaft.
Wunderschönen guten Tag hier zu.